It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the conspiracy theory QAnon treats former President Trump as a central figure, but what role does he play in encouraging its false claims? Following a Trump rally with a nod to QAnon and several social media posts, we'll look at the back and forth between the Q movement and the former president. First, the pandemic saw many cities allow bars and restaurants to expand out into sidewalks and streets for safer outdoor dining. It took away some parking and made many areas more pedestrian-friendly. As we've moved back to more of a post-pandemic-ish normal, it's raised questions about how we should use street space in our communities. Our next guest says free or cheap parking comes at a big cost, that cities should stop offering free parking for vehicles and stop requiring new construction developments to include off-street parking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important is parking to you? When you look at your community, big or small, downtown or maybe on the outskirts, do you think there is too much space for parking? Not enough? Do you want to see changes? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Donald Shoup is a distinguished research professor in the Department of Urban Planning at UCLA. He's the author of the book, The High Cost of Free Parking. Don, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
I've been arguing for years, Don, that there's really no such thing as free parking. In a nutshell, what are some of the biggest costs of providing parking, either for free or under market value?
Well, I think that the right person to pay for parking is the driver. And I think the drivers don't want to pay for parking, including you and me. So I think that we've made parking very different from everything else in the economy. It's almost all free everywhere. I'm not against free parking. I'm against the idea of underpriced parking. I think the right price for curb parking is the lowest price that cities can charge and have one or two open spaces. So for most of the city, that would be free. But in crowded areas, I think you should charge the right price, meaning the lowest price the city can charge, have one or two open spaces on every block, so the drivers would always see an open parking space wherever they go. It wouldn't be free, but it would be easy. I think the parking should be easy to find and easy to pay for, but not necessarily free.
What has led to kind of the thinking that we had that we provide as much parking as humanly possible? What led to our, I guess, current state of affairs?
Well, it wasn't the automobile industry. I think it was their customers who want free parking. And I think that the key to getting parking prices right is to do what some cities are doing now, is to establish parking benefit districts that have two features. One, they charge this the right price for curb parking, so there are open spaces available everywhere. And then the important thing is that they spend all the meter revenue to pay for added public services on the metered blocks. They repair sidewalks, they plant street trees. Some cities give free Wi-Fi to everybody on the metered streets, or they give free transit passes to everybody on the metered streets, so that the residents see the advantage of the paid parking, because they're going to get public services paid for by the parking meters. And the cities that have done that have been found really successful, that if they do one, they start adding more. So I think especially in compact areas, densely populated areas, where there are many more people than there are curb parking spaces.
Speaking of people versus parking spaces, I've seen some statistics about how much space we provide to park our cars in one place or another versus how much space we provide, say, people to live in. Can you talk about how that's shaped our landscapes?
Well, yes, I think we have so much parking because we have these minimum parking requirements everywhere. If you're going to have free curb parking, you have to provide off-street parking, or else people will drive around endlessly hunting for a curb parking space. So we've solved the shortage of parking by requiring off-street parking everywhere, which drives up the price of everything, especially housing. Many cities, you can't build any apartments with less than two parking spaces, or in L.A., 2.5 parking spaces. So that everybody pays for parking except for the drivers. And that means that we all pay for parking except in our role as a driver.
We're talking to Donald Shoup, Distinguished Research Professor at UCLA in Urban Planning, author of the book, The High Cost of Free Parking. He says in a lot of our communities, we need to rethink the priority we put on parking. Main point, where parking is scarce in particular, make sure drivers are paying for it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Give us a report from your community, big or small. Do you feel like there's not enough parking or it's too expensive? Or do you think there's maybe too much priority being put on convenient parking? At what cost and to whom? What would you like to see change, if anything? And what questions do you have for our guest, who's been looking at these issues for quite a while now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Don, I understand at the outset of your career, not many people were looking at the economics of parking. What led you down that path?
Well, I started out studying in land economics, and I wrote my PhD dissertation on that, and then I realized that parking is the single biggest land use in any city, that more than housing, more than commerce, more than anything else. And yet, people had, certainly academics, hadn't paid much attention. Say, transportation planners didn't pay any attention to curb parking because nothing is moving. Land use planners didn't think about curb parking because it's in the roadway. Nobody had paid much attention to it. But I think now that people are thinking carefully about it, they think that, well, yes, our cities are designed for cars. I think if most neighborhoods wouldn't object to that there being more people if they didn't bring cars. Mm-hmm. And with parking requirements, it ensures that they do bring cars. Say, you started off talking about the converting some curb parking spaces into dining. It's been a terrific success in most cities that the curb parking space that's turned into a restaurant hires many more people and serves many more people and pays many more taxes than one empty car. So I think that the COVID has made a big difference in that regard to opening our eyes. But maybe it's happened in Wisconsin cities, too, that the biggest success in places like Los Angeles is what they call the alfresco program, is that the restaurants can turn their parking lots into outdoor dining, which is just the opposite of minimum parking requirements, which says that if you have more seats, you have to have more parking. And this is turning into more seats and less parking. And it is wildly successful because it's being made permanent as well. For restaurants, do you really think that you have to reserve the space for cars rather than for people? But that's what minimum parking requirements do, that the land cannot be used for dining. It has to be used for cars. And most people are waking up to the fact that minimum parking requirements are a pseudoscience. They look scientific, but planners don't know how to set parking requirements. They learn nothing about it during their planning education because their professors have nothing to teach. All the planning students learn about minimum parking requirements is that they get in the way of everything they want to do, have affordable housing or have walkable neighborhoods or have a better urban design. No, I think that COVID, as you pointed out at the beginning, has opened our eyes to what other cities are doing already. Say, there are other cities around Wisconsin. Say, Minneapolis has gotten rid of its parking requirements, and Buffalo, and South Bend, Indiana, and Ann Arbor. There are a lot of. I can imagine there are many parts of cities, in the denser parts of cities, in in Wisconsin where you could begin to charge the market price for curb parking, just equate supply and demand, and spend the revenue to repair sidewalks, or in your part of the world, shovel snow. Make sure that the meter money, if it shoveled snow as soon as it fell, I suspect people would say, well, I can see that. That the parking meters are paying for something I want, and I won't get that unless we charge for curb parking.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ron is with us in River Hills. Ron, hi.
Hi there. Well, my question is two-part in a sense. That is, there are some cities in the world that are eliminating parking in their city altogether. Part of it is, I think, the environmental movement. Part of it is people should be the priority in cities and not cars and transportation like cars. And I'd like to know if there are any cities in the United States that are following that format.
Ron, thanks for the call. Don, forbidding apartment buildings to even have parking spaces. Have we seen this in the U.S.?
Yes. We're not talking about getting rid of parking spaces. We're talking about getting rid of parking requirements,
right,
and charging for scarce curb parking. You know, I think a city where everyone happily pays for everybody else's free parking is a ship of fools. But I agree with the caller. And I think that the cities that have begun with these parking reforms that I recommend, which is charging the right price for curb parking and spending the revenue on public services on the metered streets and getting rid of parking requirements, I think the best examples are San Francisco and Portland and Pasadena, California was one of the first cities that did this. But it's spreading. Say several cities in Texas have gotten rid of their parking requirements and start charging for the right prices for curb parking and spend the revenue on metered services. I think whether you're a communist or a capitalist, many people would agree that clean and safe sidewalks are more important than free parking.
Thanks for that call, Ron. We're talking to UCLA urban planning professor Don Shoup about rethinking parking in our cities, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is parking like in your neighborhood, maybe in the downtown in your community? Do you wish there were better alternatives to driving and parking in the first place? How would you like to see local transportation and parking in particular change where you live or where you visit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation with Don Shoup from UCLA's Department of Urban Planning, author of the book, The High Cost of Free Parking. He says we need to make sure that drivers are paying the costs for parking wherever they park in a city or a community. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? What have you experienced in your community? Do you think of parking as a pain? Do you want more and more and cheaper and convenient parking? Or do you like this idea of charging more, using that money to pay for improvements right where that parking is? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Roger is with us in Bayfield. Roger, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Roger?
Well, in 2000, I had the privilege and honor of traveling to the old country, the Netherlands, with my mother and visited family. But one of the things I observed, and this was true in small towns, like where my grandfather was born and raised, but also in a college town, Groningen, which would be on the scale of Madison, there were parking lots on the periphery of the towns and cities, and then they had convenient, well-maintained bike paths or walking paths going into the town or city square. So people tended to park on the edge of the city, pay a fee at a meter, and then go into town and do their business, whatever their business was.
Interesting. Roger, thanks for that call. What do you think of the idea, I guess, of parking on the periphery like that, Don?
Well, I think that the right prices will encourage people to do that. The price will be for curb parking will be higher in the center of town but lower in the periphery. So somebody who wants to save money can park in the periphery and walk farther or bicycle. But some people, they're in a hurry or they're late for an appointment or something like that. They may want to drive closer to the center and pay more so everybody can make the right choice for them. But that's only if the curb parking is priced properly, so that if it has one or two open spaces, it's like the Supreme Court's definition of pornography. I know it when I see it. You just look at a block and you can tell whether the price is too high or too low by whether all the spaces are empty, then the price is probably too high. If none are empty, are vacant and open, the price is too low. So I think that this Goldilocks pricing is the right one. People may have to pay for parking, but it'll always be available. And as in the Netherlands, that they price the parking properly. I think the parking policies in the Netherlands are among the best in the world. And I think that if we adopted that kind of parking policy, we would be able to reclaim land from parking like the Netherlands reclaimed land from the ocean. That we have a lot of land that is now committed to parking by law. And I think all we have to do, it doesn't cost anything to repeal a parking requirement, as in the many cities have done it. At no cost, we could begin reclaiming this land that city planners have dedicated to parking for almost 100 years.
Thanks for that call, Roger. We heard from Mark in Richland Center, who says, lack of and availability of public transportation. How does that influence parking spaces? Public transportation and parking, how do they play with each other?
Well, I think that the U.S. spends more on transportation subsidies than any other country, but we lack in this country as riders, not so much as buses. And I think that it would be much better if, say, like Boulder, Colorado, that they in their downtown they have parking meters and they give free transit passes to everybody who lives or works downtown. So I think that that will increase the demand for transit, and if the demand increases, they can run buses more frequently. And I think that if you begin charging for curb parking, you'll find that it's not as precious as people thought. That in San Francisco, when they started charging for curb parking, the prices went down to 25 cents an hour on 17% of the meters of the city. So I think that you'll be able to find out that, well, we could have bus lanes, which would speed buses and bicycle lanes. You can't, if the price of parking is very low, that it'll signify that the drivers are not demanding very much. And we could have more dedicated bus lanes and more dedicated bike lanes.
Thanks for that call. Don, I want to bring up a particular constituency that I imagine you run into sometimes, downtown business owners. In another life, I was at downtown business group meetings, and a big concern was, okay, our competition in the malls or the big box stores has infinite free parking, basically, to compete on a level playing field. They might say, we need this subsidized, inexpensive, convenient parking. If you bump up the prices, you're just sending our customers out to those stores with the huge parking lots. What do you say to convince them that a change is needed?
Well, remember, the price I'm recommending is just one or two open spaces on every block. So you can't say that people are being driven away. The only people who aren't coming are people who are unwilling to pay for parking, and their spaces will be taken by people who are willing to pay for parking. And who do you think will leave a bigger tip at a restaurant? Somebody won't come downtown unless they can drive around for 15 minutes to find a free curb parking space, or somebody who's willing to pay for parking right on the block of the restaurant if they can find a space. So I think that and cities that have done what I'm talking about, like Pasadena is the famous example of it, that they had free parking everywhere, and the merchants and their employees moved their cars every two hours to get it, keep a free space. So they complained about lack of parking for the customers. So when the city said, "Well, we'll put in the parking meters and we'll give you all the revenue to fix up every sidewalk in the neighborhood," they said, "Well, let's do that. Let's run the meters till midnight. Let's run up on Sunday. Let's charge a high price." And the sales tax revenue in the 5 years after they put in the meters and spent the revenue on added public services, the sales tax revenue tripled, meaning which is a measure of business activity. So you cannot say that it's going to the charging the right price for curb parking and spending the revenue in downtown is going to harm downtown.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
That's Donald Shoup, a distinguished research professor in the Department of Urban Planning at UCLA. He's the author of the book, The High Cost of Free Parking. He's with us today sharing his research on the problems with public parking in cities and why even free parking isn't really free. Still time for you to weigh in with your experiences in your hometown or around the world. What bugs you about parking? Not enough of it, too expensive, or too much of it and too cheap, as our guest was saying. Share your experiences, maybe your reactions. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, a Trump rally this past weekend played what's believed to be a theme song from the QAnon conspiracy theory movement, while the former president has been sharing the movement's messages on his social media platform. A political scientist joins us to talk about what kind of impact the former president has on keeping the QAnon theory alive. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, yeet. We're talking about the new words Merriam-Webster just added to their dictionary. Find out what makes a word stand the test of time with the hosts of the public radio show Away With Words. Now, former President Donald Trump held a rally in Ohio this past Saturday in which a song was played that many say sounds like a theme song of the QAnon conspiracy movement called WWG1WGA, abbreviated from the QAnon slogan, "Where we go one, we go all." Trump's supporters responded to the song by holding up a finger alluding to the word one from the slogan. Trump has recently been sharing QAnon-themed messages on Truth Social, his social media platform. QAnon is complicated. It's an American political conspiracy theory often believed by political members of the far right. It started mostly in 2017, an effort to claim that Trump is fighting against a widespread pedophile movement. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this conspiracy theory online among people you know, family members? How much of an impact do you see it having, maybe on American politics? What do you think of the idea of the former president now more or less actively promoting the conspiracy theory? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Melissa Deckman is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and a political scientist who studies the impact of gender, religion, and age on public opinion and political behavior. Melissa, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I gave a very basic outline of QAnon. Can you tell us a little more about what goes into this conspiracy theory?
Sure. So my research institute, PRI, began tracking whether or not Americans could be classified as followers of QAnon. And essentially, we basically boil it down to three core beliefs. So folks who are QAnon believers believe that the government, media, and financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. They also believe that a storm is coming soon that will sweep away the elites in power and restore rightful leaders to the country. And lastly, they endorse political violence. We have a question where we ask Americans, because things have gotten so far off track, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save the country. To what extent do you believe that? What we find is that when we take those three elements together, it really actually provides a pretty accurate estimate of who would be classified as someone who would be a QAnon follower. And we find in our research, we started tracking this back in March of 2021. And most recently, we did a big report in March of this year. We find that about 18% of Americans can be classified as someone who believes in QAnon.
This centered around the role of then President Trump in many ways, and many of the specific claims that came out of this theory offered specific dates where, as you mentioned, the storm would come, where President Trump would arrest, possibly execute a lot of high-ranking officials, Democrats in particular. Those days, of course, came and went. Those things didn't happen. And yet in your surveys, you find the conspiracy theory itself didn't dwindle after that.
No. In fact, we were maybe a little bit surprised just how entrenched it's become among some Americans. You know, I think with conspiracy theories, these are obviously unfounded in reality. There's really no proof. But our research finds that Americans who tend to adopt them surround themselves with other people who have those theories, but they also watch media sources that also tend to reinforce those ideas. So if your steady stream of information is that these things are true and you're hearing it repeatedly during the day and you have political leaders that who you emulate are saying it, then I think it's hard to get out of that bubble where you're just being fed this disinformation.
Now, with some conspiracy theories, flat earth or moon landing things or things like that, like if you believe them, you're wrong, but maybe no harm done, right? I mean, it's not going to change your behavior in the world. Do you have concerns that something like a movement like QAnon is going to have real world consequences?
Absolutely. This is the real threat that we're facing in terms of our democracy. The link here, I think, that worries us and worries many Americans who follow this is the resort to violence aspect of this. Because when you suddenly have a group of Americans who think it's legitimate to use political violence to overturn the results of an election they think were stolen from a political leader, that is really cause for concern. And we see in many Republican races across the country, not all by any means, and I should indicate that most Republicans are not QAnon believers, but there are some Republicans who won primaries who really do, in fact, embrace these theories. And I think we're setting up a situation in some states where if those folks, for example, lose the general election in the fall, or actually if they win the election and then future elections, for example, for the presidency in 2024, indicate that the Republican doesn't win, are they going to overturn those elections? And will they use violence to try to set that those kinds of activities in place? And so that's really where the threat is in terms of our democracy.
Talking to Melissa Deckman from the Public Religion Research Institute, looking at the QAnon conspiracy theory and former President Trump more openly promoting it in recent weeks. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melissa, the role of the former president here during his term in office, there was a thought that he kind of kept this Q movement at arm's length, only referred to it obliquely. There are reports that at his rallies, people were encouraged to actually cover up any Q-related paraphernalia. Now we have him nodding at a rally, playing music related to the movement, posting on his social media sites, sharing openly QAnon posts with the phrases, you know, the storm is coming and other trademark hallmarks of the conspiracy. What do you make of that change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty remarkable that he played this song that's affiliated with QAnon at the rally. But one analysis by the Associated Press found over the last month of nearly 75 accounts that Trump has reposted on his social truth media website, Truth Social rather, about a third of those posts have promoted QAnon movement slogans, videos, or imagery. So we've moved from sort of the wink and nod that I think Trump used to do with respect to QAnon prior to the 2020 election to a more open embrace of it. And I think it's happening for two reasons. One, he's in a lot of legal jeopardy right now. And if you'll notice, in the past couple of weeks, he's been given media interviews where he's essentially said, if the FBI or if the Justice Department actually goes through and prosecutes him, he's basically saying that there are a group of citizens who will react in a way that is violent. So I think he's sending a message that don't prosecute me because I have people who are here who will essentially have his back. I think secondly, though, Donald Trump still, I think, the most popular figure within the GOP. He still has a strong base of support among Republicans. But there are certainly political leaders looking to run for president in his party. I think of someone, of course, probably most famously, someone like Ron DeSantis. So I think he's trying to ward off potential folks to run against him in the 2024 election. So those are the two factors, I think, that has led Donald Trump, in fact, to be more open in his embrace of QAnon, because QAnon supporters are probably the most loyal Trump followers out there today.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hello.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for this segment. I heard the 18% figure that the guest shared, and that's frankly terrifying to me that significant, that large of a chunk of the population is willing to do violence. And I guess I was wondering if the guest has any insight into the question of sort of how such a sizable segment of the population bought into something that is, frankly, so ludicrous.
Michael, thanks for that call. Melissa, what do we know, what don't we know about why many people, as Michael says, have bought into this movement?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think it kind of gets into larger questions about why people adopt conspiracy theories in general. I think part of it lies in the fact that we did a deeper dive into looking at folks who believe QAnon and what they're like. A lot of QAnon believers, I think, tend to have lots of what we might call cultural grievances, right? They look at the way that America is changing in terms of race, in terms of less religious believers, in terms of all these other larger threats in society, the growth, for example, in the number of Americans who identify as LGBTQ+, all these sorts of things are viewed as, I think, threats to them. And so I think for some people, looking to a source like QAnon gives them some sort of hope and makes some sort of sense for them in the world. And it's just really often difficult to disabuse people of conspiracy theories, especially if they remain entrenched in those social media sites where they're hearing the same untruths happen over and over again.
Thanks for that call. Melissa, you're at an outfit that studies religion in particular, and it sounds like there is almost a religious as much of a political attachment to this conspiracy theory in some ways.
I think that there's certainly some overlap, right? If you had a Venn diagram of what we might call Christian nationalists, and these are Americans who believe that we need to have almost a theocracy return, you know, or to have sort of conservative Christians remain in power and make laws that sort of reemphasize those ideologies. There is some overlap between strong Christian nationalist beliefs and QAnon believers. But it's not merely, I think, a religious movement in and of itself. Certainly, I do think that there are some correlations between those two things.
We're talking to Melissa Deckman, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, about the impact former President Donald Trump has on promoting the conspiracy theory QAnon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think QAnon is a serious threat? Do you know anyone who believes in QAnon that you're maybe worried about? What do you think about the former president now more openly supporting the conspiracy theory? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Melissa Deckman, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. Melissa's talking with us about the impact former President Trump has on encouraging the QAnon conspiracy theory movement, especially after a series of pro-QAnon posts promoted by the former president on his social media site. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this conspiracy theory and those who believe it, the impact on politics it has, or do you have thoughts? Have you had encounters with that among your coworkers, maybe family members or people you know online, for better or worse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org with your thoughts or your questions. Melissa, as you mentioned, you were surprised to see the persistence of these ideas into 2021, 2022. Now we have, again, the former president who is, you know, the star in some ways of this conspiracy theory as designed by those promoting it, now actually communicating with it, promoting it in some ways. What are you watching for to see what kind of impact that then has on belief in this theory?
You know, it's interesting to see Trump sort of switch to a more overt embrace of QAnon. And I think there's possibly, you know, I'm thinking that it might even have a little bit more of a backlash. Again, we find that roughly 18% of Americans basically fall into this category of QAnon believers. It's a minority of the country. And I think that by embracing it, you know, the reality is that most Americans don't accept it. And so I think potentially this might even signal that Trump is in sort of a weaker state than he was certainly going into the 2020 election. So I think there's a potential for a backlash to this. And it might even play into the hands, I think, of some of his rivals within the Republican Party who are seeking that nomination in 2024.
Now, when I talked to one of your colleagues about the survey that's providing some of our data here, an interesting point was you were looking at the beliefs attached to it, not asking directly, are you a follower of this conspiracy theory? It's not so much the brand as the beliefs you've been following. Do you think that fewer people might say, yeah, I follow this theory versus I hold these beliefs that line up with this theory?
That's a very, very good point. You know, it's really hard in a survey to say, do you follow QAnon? Because we'd find essentially that many Americans probably wouldn't say yes. And so our research team actually went on QAnon sites and were looking for language and common themes that they saw on those sites. And that was really the basis of the questions that we asked. And so in putting that together, I think it actually holds together as a pretty good scale. But I do think also in terms of political violence, I think the problem is, it's not that we're necessarily going to be seeing 18% of Americans tomorrow going and storming the Capitol, although frankly, with January 6th, we did see a lot of the folks who stormed the Capitol in January 6th, the insurrection, were linked to QAnon and having those beliefs. But it's more that, are we allowing, you know, certain political leaders to justify certain undemocratic principles going forward? I mean, I think that's really kind of the challenge. And where we go in the future, when you're allowed to justify these sorts of undemocratic principles, and that's, I think, where we really want to keep track of where this movement is headed, certainly.
And then looking at your data, can you tell us a little more about what we know about who finds these QAnon ideas most appealing?
Sure. So we find that, for example, the biggest indicator of denoting whether someone is what we would call a QAnon follower or holds those QAnon sort of beliefs are linked to media sources. So if you follow OANN or Newsmax, some of these far right news sources, you're far more likely to believe in QAnon or to embrace some of the ideas that QAnon purports. We find education is strongly linked. So if you are high school degree or less, you're more likely to be someone who subscribes to some of these QAnon beliefs. We also find Republicans more than the Democrats and independents are more likely to believe those things as well.
We heard from Kurt in Elgin, Illinois, who couldn't stay on the line, wonders if we know how many police officers in Wisconsin or around the U.S. are members of QAnon. I don't remember off the top of my head if you looked specifically at different professions, Melissa, in this survey.
Yeah, that's a great question. Unfortunately, we didn't ask about people's professions, but, you know, I do think that there is a concern about the role of sheriffs in some more conservative communities. I haven't really seen any data on whether they purport to believe QAnon theories per se, but there is a growing concern that some sheriffs might be willing to embrace tendencies toward, you know, some of those, the idea that the election was stolen from Donald Trump and those sorts of things. So that's actually a really good question we should look into, definitely.
We're talking to Melissa Deckman, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, looking at the QAnon conspiracy movement, the former president, Donald Trump, supporting it now more, at least in posts on his social media site, and some of the demographics and the research into who follows the beliefs of this conspiracy theory. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Melissa, do you see, I don't know, social issues leading people maybe to turn towards something like QAnon? You were starting to touch on this a little earlier, resentment over things like inequities in society or suspicion of elites, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of suspicion of elites, I think we see that and those kind of cultural threats. I think the other thing too is that there's a big debate in this country about gender identity. And I think that we have a younger generation of Americans who are more racially diverse, religiously diverse, or less religious, but also willing to identify as LGBTQ. And I think it's interesting that we see, for example, on far-right media sources, and we see in school boards across the country, concerns about how to deal with gender identity. And so I think it's important. One of the questions we ask about is this idea of pedophilia. And if you'd asked me, you know, decades ago as a survey researcher, we'd be asking Americans if they agree the U.S. was controlled by Satan-worshipping pedophiles. I would have said that's pretty ludicrous. But I do think that this idea that we have, you know, people grooming children in public schools to embrace these alternative gender identities, you see that happening a lot on certain media outlets. And I think that that's where you see that language potentially appealing to some people that who maybe ahead of this time would never have embraced these sorts of beliefs that are not at all grounded in fact.
Yeah. Do you see some of these ideas finding their way more and more into the mainstream, even if they're not expressed quite as openly?
Well, I think that it's maybe not in the mainstream per se, but I do think that you know, it's an attempt to sort of recast violence against Democrats, LGBT people, as defending children, right? And normalizing this kind of ideology. And that's the part that I think that is really, really troubling.
In our last couple of minutes, you've done surveys in the past. What kind of research are you looking to in the future to follow the spread of this idea, see how it morphs, changes, declines, or increases?
Sure. We're certainly going to be, I think, for the near future, looking at these ideas about QAnon beliefs, certainly. But we're also expanding into Americans' ideas about democracy, the health of our democracy. We have at PRI an initiative where we're calling it, in fact, Religion and Renewing Democracy. But we are growing concerned about these undemocratic values that are being embraced by people. The idea, for example, that resorting to violence would be necessary to save our country is something that we're certainly keeping our eye on, because it is a challenge to the health of our democracy in the future.
It's easy for a conspiracy theory to spread. Melissa, do you see ways to spread more pro-democracy, anti-violence ideas in a positive way?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the question that many researchers and political scientists and people who care about the health and safety of our democracy are really concerned about right now. I think the unfortunate thing is that it's hard lifting. It's a hard lift in the sense that there is a way to combat this misinformation, but it's often through meeting other people who are different from you, right? Who hold different views, and sort of demystifying what people are on the other side of the political aisle. I mean, unfortunately, we live in a political time, it seems, where partisanship has become a social identity, right? And we are defining the other side as being inherently, you know, not good people, and we're not trusting what other people are saying. And those sorts of relationships really can be rebuilt by kind of taking time to meet other people who aren't like you. That's hard to do. It's effective. It's hard to do. But that, I think, is the great challenge we face here in American democracy and society overall.
Melissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Melissa Deckman, the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and political scientist who studies the impact of gender, religion, and age on public opinion and political behavior. She joined us today to talk about former President Trump's connection with the conspiracy theory QAnon. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's a look at beer through the ages. Start off with a look at the state of small breweries in Wisconsin, a brewer's round table, as I understand it. You can get started on that right now if you're a brewer yourself or a fan of someone's work. Share your thoughts. Email right now at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's beers of the present and future. Then dig deep into the archaeology of prehistoric beer, one of the oldest signs of human civilization, as I understand it, brewing. So it's all things beer, past and present. Again, join in with your favorites. Email ideas@WPR.org. And then join that conversation coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you spend time outside at all, there's a good chance you see ants pretty often. And hey, sometimes ants show up inside too. And it can seem like there are a lot of ants out there. But like, how many are there on planet Earth? Well, now we have an answer, or at least an estimate. According to a new Nature survey published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, there are 20 quadrillion ants on this here planet. So I had to think about that. Quadrillions, right? You've got ones, thousands, millions, billions, trillions. Then you hit quadrillions. A quadrillion is a one with 15 zeros. Now take that times 20, and there's ants. Or take a trillion, then think about 20,000 of those. Long story short, it's a lot of ants. I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. It's science news you can use. This is Central Time.